Space Shuttle Atlantis has landed, concluding the final mission of its 25-year career. Fresh off a 12-day mission to the International Space Station, the shuttle landed as scheduled at 8:48 a.m. Eastern Time to end its 32nd flight. Atlantis is the first shuttle to be retired. Two other missions are planned before the shuttle space program ends, one for Discovery in September, one for Endeavour in November. Atlantis, which lifted off Friday afternoon from Kennedy Space Center, made its maiden voyage in 1985 and has since logged about 121 million miles in space. During its career, it carried into orbit the Magellan spacecraft, which went on to map 98% of the planet Venus. It also sent the Galileo spacecraft on its way to collect data about Jupiter and its moons for 8 years. As you know, President Obama has called for a new strategy that ends current programs while funding new initiatives intended to propel humankind further into the solar system. But there are many who are unhappy with that program. Up next, Howard Bloom starts our special space show on Coast to Coast AM. And you're listening to Coast Worldwide. I'm George Norrie. Throughout the evening tonight, we will have various guests coming and going talking about the space program, the Obama initiative, and what it all means to you. And to talk about the philosophy of space, why we quest to go out into space, is someone I call the human computer. I call him that because he's got a mind like a computer, Howard Bloom. Howard is the founder of the International Paleopsychology Project and the Big Bang Tango Media Lab, in addition to being the founding board member of the Epic of Evolution Society and the Darwin Project. He is also a member of the New York Academy of Sciences, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Psychological Society, and probably a million other organizations. Here's Howard Bloom back on Coast to Coast. Howard, how are you?
George, it's good to see you. I haven't seen you in 5 months.
It's a pleasure, my friend. How are you feeling these days?
Well, I have a question.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the president's space program? There's this huge uproar about it.
Well, I think we should do more. You know,
yeah.
You know, as you know, as a boy, I fell in love with space. It was one of the reasons I went into broadcasting, and I just want us to do more. You know, I'm gonna probably echo the comments of all the guests tonight who will be coming and going on this program, that we need to do more in space. You know, I know the economy's bad, and I know, but I do think it'll jumpstart the economy. It'll give people jobs, and it'll give us hope in a quest, Howard.
I agree with you so profoundly, George. You wouldn't believe it. Because a nation, we've talked about this before, a nation that looks up goes up, a nation that looks down goes down. A nation without a sense of a new frontier begins to cave in upon itself. It begins to deny itself things. It begins it gives up on life. It's like a bacterial colony that can't find any resources and goes into sporulation. It just turns, a bacterial colony turns into a hard, tight little crystal, just holding on for the next time that there will be an opportunity. Well, this nation cannot afford to crumple. This nation cannot afford to fold up like a fist and wait for the next great rain of resources, because nations make their own resources. And they make their own resources by opening radically new frontiers. And if we don't do it, the Chinese are very anxious to do it. The Indians are very anxious to do it. And the Chinese have a lot of extra change dangling in their pockets. They have huge trade reserves. We have huge trade deficits. We've been running them ever since 1973. Right now we're running trade deficits at the rate of $500 billion a year. How do you reverse a trade deficit? You find a new frontier, you find new horizons of all kinds, and you open them up. You find new horizons of technology, you find new virtual new landscapes, like the virtual world of cyberspace, which has saved the world economy since 1990. You open up as many new territories as you possibly can, and you do it not just on behalf of human beings and not just on behalf of American civilization. You do it on behalf of life, because once upon a time on this planet, there was a teaspoonful of life. And life's imperative was to get out there, kidnap, seduce, recruit as many dead atoms as molecules as you can and bring them into the life process. And life has been up against deadlines over and over again. There have been 142 mass extinctions on this planet, and all of them occurred before smokestacks. All of them occurred before tailpipes. They were not man-made. They were nature-made. And the task of biomass has been to expand into as many new niches, as many new frontiers as you can possibly find, invent new ways to take advantage of old deserts.
Well said. You know, Howard, I was talking with producer Tom Danheiser last week about this upcoming Stanley Cup series, which now is going to find Philadelphia playing Chicago, the Blackhawks.
Right.
And, of course, I am an avid Detroit Red Wing fan, and they made it through the first round, and then they petered off, and they didn't make it after that. But the bottom line was they have won Stanley Cups before. And after they win the cup, you're euphoric for a moment. And the moment is, hey, we won. But then you realize, and then it hits you, that you have to win it next year.
Right.
If you're going to have that same feeling.
Absolutely.
And it's like the space program. We were the first to get to the moon. We were there. We're going to have Buzz Aldrin on next hour.
Right.
And we're going to find out from him what it was like to walk on the moon, what that spirit was like to be first. But that Stanley Cup is over. And there's a new series coming.
Exactly.
And we got to win.
You have got it. And if you look, I've been working with Buzz for 3 years. I founded something that Buzz Aldrin and Edgar Mitchell were very instrumental in getting me involved in. Edgar Mitchell is the sixth man on the moon.
Yep, and Apollo 14.
Right, and that's the Space Development Steering Committee. And Buzz and I have been working on the Aldrin Unified Space Vision, and you'll see that it sets out a whole string of goals for us, each of which we should be the first to achieve. We are ahead of the rest of the world in producing a heavy lift vehicle, something that can get large amounts of cargo into space. Now, Ares, which is what's happening in the space community right now, is there's a $60 billion boondoggle for a rocket called the Ares. And the companies that have the nipple of that boondoggle in their mouth do not want to let go of it. And they are trying to tell the American people that if we go with the Obama space program, we're throwing away America's leadership in space because we're throwing away the Ares. That's not true. Right now, Elon Musk, who turns out to be one of the great saviors of the moment, Elon Musk is the head of SpaceX and Tesla Motors. Well, you've heard and probably read many of the headlines over the last few days about the fact that Tesla is reopening the NUMMI plant, the Toyota and General Motors joint venture plant,
right,
for Tesla cars. And if you take a look at the Tesla sites online, you'll see a Tesla Model S vehicle that seats seven people and goes from 0 to 65 miles an hour in something like 4.5 seconds. It's an astonishing vehicle. Well, that's our way into the future. Our way into the future is to produce things that other people want and need. Facebook, Google, Apple, these are all things that are producing things that other people need. But the real rain of resources is right there over our head. And you know that we've talked about power. Look what's happening right now with our energy problems. There have been three major mining disasters in the last 6 months. Two of them were in China, and one of them was in the United States. They were terrible. How do you calculate the value of a lost life? You can't. 11 people were killed in Louisiana when the oil platform blew up. And now, look at the damage. It's costing us $1 billion so far to try to remediate the problem with the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. And the lost amounts of money in tourism and shrimping and all kinds of other industries are going to come into the billions of dollars, too. We can harvest solar energy in space and send it down to Earth without any of those problems, because we can send it down, we can transmit it down with radio waves, the same kind of radio waves that you use in your cell phone. And now it's expensive, but look at the expenses we're undergoing for these terrestrial sources of energy, and look at the disasters we're undergoing, and those disasters are likely to get worse. Up there, once you send the power down to Earth, it's endless. The United States does not have to fight in Gulf wars anymore, does not have to fight in Iraq, does not have to fight in Afghanistan, at least not over energy resources. There will still be reasons to fight. Mankind is a contentious bunch. We
That's
like
so
to squabble. But the fact is, we will take the load off of the Earth, to use the expression that one of my partners in this whole space thing has coined. And we need to do that. We need to be able to get unending amounts of energy. We need to be able to capture an asteroid and turn it. And one asteroid has $1 trillion to $17 trillion worth of resources. $1 trillion is the equivalent of the gross domestic product of Korea. And those resources are resources we're going to need for, guess what, electric cars.
Electric cars
use a lot of lithium. They use a lot of platinum. They use a lot of rare earth minerals. Well, already Bolivia is looking at our lithium situation and saying, oh, my God, we're sitting on half the world's lithium. And those guys up north are really going to need it. Why don't we form a cartel like the old OPEC?
Mm-hmm. Smart.
And strangle them. And the Chinese have bought up most of the rare earth mineral resources. And they're saying the same thing. So as we jump into the electric future, the future of electric transportation, which we need to do, there's going to be another stranglehold over us, one, two of them, one for lithium and one for rare earth minerals. You've got $1 trillion of material in an asteroid and $17 trillion in a bigger asteroid. And guess what else you've got up there? These giant snowballs. They are called comets. And what now, what is a giant snowball good for? Well, it's made of water. And what can you break water down into if you've got infinite supplies of electricity?
Hydrogen.
Yes, hydrogen and oxygen. And guess what hydrogen and oxygen are? They are the fuels for spaceships.
Yep, they sure are. Now, let me, what is, what's the reason why we need to go into space? What are we looking for?
Well, there are several things. First of all, we are the only, life is a restless matter. Life is always looking for new opportunities. Now, bacteria find all kinds of opportunities all over the place. We've talked about the fact that 2 miles beneath our feet right now, there are bacteria called chemolitho autotrophs that are turning granite into life stuff. They are turning granite into food and fuel. We're the only life form that can take life beyond the atmosphere. We're the only life form that can take life into low Earth orbit. We are the only life form that can take life to Phobos, the moon of Mars, that can take life to Mars itself. We're the only opportunity for life to leap off this one tiny fragile planet and open first the solar system and then the stars. What are we looking for up there? We're looking for real estate and energy. Wherever humans go, there's an economy. Once upon a time, there was a war. America went into a war that was considered so unjust by some that Henry David Thoreau wrote on civil disobedience as an anti-war pamphlet. It was the war with Mexico in 1848. We won it. Now, what in the world did we win? We won New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, California, among other things. And generals who were experts in logistics absolutely knew how to measure the landscape and see exactly what you could pull out of it and what you couldn't were sent out there to evaluate this territory. And they came back and they said, gentlemen, there is nothing up there but an empty space. There is no point in investing even a penny in it. This land is good for only two things, rattlesnakes and scorpions.
Jeez. Howard, stay with us. We're going to be back in just a moment. We'll take a few phone calls also with you before Buzz Aldrin joins us next hour on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. We shall be right back as we talk about space on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, Apollo 11 astronaut Buzz Aldrin joins us. Howard Bloom will take a few calls with you and will be with us next hour as well. Later, science advisor Richard C. Hoagland joins us into the conversation along with Robert Zubrin on Coast to Coast AM, and we'll be right back. Is there a limit how much we should spend, Howard Bloom, to go into space, to do what we need to do?
The president's new program actually gives $6 billion to the space program in addition to the money that was previously allocated. I can't say how much we should spend, George. I'm like you. I want it all. I really want it all.
Me too.
I want America to be the first with a heavy lift vehicle. I want the America. One plan on the drawing boards is to take a giant version of the space shuttle using modern technology like the X-37B. Have you followed the X-37B?
I sure have.
Okay. Well, imagine that X-37B with all of its brand new materials, with its electronic avionics and all the rest, scaled up to an enormous size so that instead of using a disposable Atlas V rocket to take stuff into space, you can use basically a giant X-37B, which looks like a giant space shuttle, to do the first part of getting a smaller space shuttle-like vehicle into space. And then you fly back the booster that you've used to get the vehicle into space, if you follow what I'm saying. There's a giant space shuttle carrying a smaller space shuttle into space. And the giant space shuttle is no longer disposable. You don't have to throw it away into the sea. You land it, and then you refuel it, and you let it take off again, carrying another great big space shuttle, even though it's an even bigger space shuttle. Is that image clear, or is that fuzzy?
Yeah, it's perfect. Let's get some views here on whether we should continue with the space program, go back to the moon, and go on to Mars. The president wants to go to Mars, but it's a long time from now.
He wants to go to Mars. Buzz wants to go to Phobos, and I believe Phobos is a moon of Mars.
Yep,
we set up
sure
a space
is.
Base. And it's easier, Buzz will tell you, it's much easier to set up a base on Phobos and then use it to probe Mars and eventually to inhabit Mars than it is to go straight to Mars. All that seems consistent with the president's space program. What do you think, before we take calls, what do you think about Elon Musk's SpaceX and the rocket that he has on the launch pad in Florida that will get its next test run over the next couple of weeks.
I think any time we can privatize space and do it the right way, it's well worth it.
And me too. And so that rocket has great hope because the engines, once those engines prove themselves, remember, everything that you test goes wrong a few times. You have a few rockets that blow up. You can't be flawless when you're in the testing phase, but because you use those tests in order to straighten out your flaws. But strap a bunch of those rockets together, and you've got something that Elon calls the Falcon 9 Heavy. And the Falcon 9 Heavy is a step on the way to what Elon really wants to achieve. Elon doesn't want to stop in low Earth orbit and put up space solar power satellites. Not at all. He wants to go straight to Mars with privately built spacecraft.
Absolutely. When Richard C. Hoagland joins us later on, Howard, you and Buzz, thank you, by the way, for spending a couple hours with us. I want to get into new technologies with him as well. What's out there? What's happening? Because there are some exciting things going on in space. It's just that we want mankind to be part of it.
Absolutely. And that's and the extra $6 million or $6 billion that the president has put into it is going to help us accomplish exactly that because it's going to encourage people like Elon Musk and various other competitors like Orbital Sciences to get out there and compete to be the companies that deliver government cargo to space using a government contract but with their own rockets.
Let's see how you feel. Let's go to Dalton, Georgia to get things started. First-time caller, Chris, you're on with us. Hey, Chris, go ahead.
Howard? This is
Howard. Howard Bloom's on.
Okay, I kind of think, you know, I'm 34 years old, and I'm just, you know, I work in like a factory, and I think, you know, we need to try to get this world together and quit spending so much money on something we're never going to know what's out there. It's just too far away, you know what I'm saying? And why waste all that money on that, you know, when our world just completely falling apart?
All right, what do you think of that argument, Howard? Spend it all here.
Chris, one of the things that happened during the 19th century when we were opening up, remember this land of vast desert that was a land of scorpions and rattlesnakes and good for nothing that I was talking about, the West Coast? Well, we opened up the West Coast during the 19th century, and one of the results was that an average factory worker, an average worker, tripled his wages during the course of the 19th century. It was astonishing. So you open new frontiers, and who benefits the most? Ultimately, it's the people not on the on the bottom benefit, the people in the middle benefit, everybody benefits. But if you don't look to new resources, Chris, you end up with the middle starving. You end up with what we've got now. We are pinched for resources, and as a consequence, our middle class is moving slowly down. To move up, we need to open new treasures. New treasures are up above our head.
Jeff is in Birmingham, Alabama, east of the Rockies. Jeff, good morning. You're up with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
If it'd been up to folks like Chris, we wouldn't have weather satellites, by the way, too. Just some questions about Aries. I was agnostic on Aries 1, but I guess I'm a little bit more of a Mike Griffin fan than a lot of other folks, and I'm glad to hear that that your guest is pro-heavy lift. But I've got a little conspiracy theory of my own here.
Sure, let's hear it.
I think that the guys at ULA pretty much have bought out the Obama administration. I do not like the Delta IV especially. We've been told this thing has black zones. They supposedly closed those out. I don't believe it. The Ares V, the Atlas V, that's smaller. The Delta IV, those are all no better than the Titan IIIs and Titan IVs we had. But I'm concerned that the heavy lift rocket program that they have now, it was just a bone that they threw to Richard Shelby to get him to go along with what Obama wanted to do. I don't think the Obama administration has any intention of building a heavy lift rocket, and this is one reason I think we should have at least kept Ares 5, if for no other reason. I'd like to keep those SRBs in play. I know I don't work for ATK, by the way. The reason I want that big core is I would love to see something like Gene Myers' Space Island Group style wet stage stations. I want to keep a lot of hydrogen and oxygen in a big core so you can keep a very large wet stage station up there. So if you went for a three-stager and we went for hydrocarbon launch vehicles, I just don't like that. Eventually those SRBs can be phased out over time. But right now I don't trust the EELVs. I think that the folks who are the fans behind the EELVs with their depot stations, I think they have lied. And right now, Elon Musk, I will say this much, his rocket was designed to fly depressed trajectory. His rocket does have engine out, but I just don't trust him as of yet. I think what we need to do is make bring our troops home and make Ares V's launch a priority.
Well, of course, if we could spend the kind of money that we're spending on Afghanistan or Iraq, then we could do all kinds of things simultaneously. But what was happening, and this is my understanding of it, Jeff, because you understand these things in the way the Buzz does. So these are questions that can be better brought up with Buzz. I'm not an expert on the details of each individual rocket. But the Ares program was eating up all of the money in the space program. It was eating up all the oxygen. It was closing down program after program after program. Nothing else could be done as long as the Ares was around. And as a consequence, the new space program is a program that allows 1,000 flowers to bloom. But the way that things were going under the Ares, and this was typical, unfortunately, of Bush vision for space exploration programs, it was killing everything off around it. It was poisonous.
Okay, thanks. Next up, let's go to our Skype line. Calhoun, Georgia, it's Billy. Go ahead, Billy, you're up with us.
Hi, George, how you doing today?
Good, Billy, all is well.
I just want to reaffirm what your guest said earlier, that it is a huge mistake not to invest in the space orbit energy factories that can beam energy down to us from satellites or so on. It is a huge, massive mistake. This is an entire new industry that, with thousands upon thousands, millions upon millions of jobs, all kind of development that would come from it. June 2008, CNN put an article out on this and said that it would cost $1 trillion to do it. And I believe that India was thinking about doing it.
India is thinking about doing it. China is thinking about doing it. The Japanese have been the first to actually put their money down. They've invested $27 million. No, it's $1 billion in developing space solar power. The Russians have shown interest in it. It makes a great deal of sense for the Chinese and the Indians because terrestrial landlines to build terrestrial landlines around across the United States that would carry the kind of intermittent power that is produced by a terrestrial solar, in other words, solar panels on the ground, and by terrestrial wind power, in other words, by windmills. To really build an entire smart grid is going to cost $1 trillion. Well, if you're going to spend $1 trillion, where should you spend it? Should you spend it on more things crawling across the face of the earth, or should you spend it on stuff up there, which is an entirely new horizon, so that everything you open up there is the beginning of infrastructure for an entirely new frontier that brings in entirely new resources and, as I said, takes the load off Earth? Well, I would choose to stop destroying desert ecosystems. Look, one of I'm blocking on the name of one of the richest men in the world. But at any rate, a friend of one of the richest men in the world.
Is he one of ours?
He's one of ours, but Warren Buffett. A friend of Warren Buffett's sent somebody over to see me out here in Brooklyn at the Tea Lounge where I work with my laptop all the time. And that person had this great scheme. He was going to take a 100-mile strip by a 100-mile strip. That's 10,000 square miles of the Mojave Desert and cover it with solar mirrors and focus all those mirrors on common centers. And those common centers would have liquid oil or liquid sodium and produce solar concentrators in order to produce terrestrial solar power. Two problems. One problem is you're destroying an entire desert ecosystem to accomplish that, the way that the windmills in the Altamont Pass in California have turned the place into a very different kind of site. And some people will find it beautiful, some people will find it ugly. And the second problem is, where are you going to get the water to wash all those mirrors? And that is not a trick question. That's not a joke. That's for real. You put these things up in space, and you've developed the beginning of a brand-new infrastructure, and you have not closed down any ecosystems.
Howard, what do you think of a Black Ops space program, one that might be going on right now that we don't know about, that's heavily funded, maybe more so than the budgetary one we know of, and they're doing all kinds of things?
Well, it would be a wonderful idea because we need to get up there one way or the other. The X-37B, though, tends to indicate, okay, the X-37B, for the members of the audience who don't know this, the X-37B is a little rocket that was sent up about a week ago on an Atlas V rocket. It looks like the space shuttle, but it's a much more modern version. It uses tiles that are far more futuristic. It uses fibers that are much more futuristic. The result is they're aiming to be able to put this thing up in space, have it do its job, take cargo up into space. Right now it's capable of putting up satellites, despite the fact that it's small, and then flying it back to Earth and landing it on a runway and turning it around in 2.5 weeks so it can go back and fly again. The goal is to be able to get aircraft-like reliability so that you can take these things off and land them as quickly as we take off and land planes. And when you do things that quickly, it lowers the cost dramatically. So but the military has developed this vehicle, has put it up into space, and has made a lot of noise about it. It's done a lot of publicity on it. Why? Because the things the military are developing, the military knows exactly what you said, George, that when you give people a feeling of a victory, you give them exhilaration, and you give them the taste of winning, which makes them want to win again. But when you start losing steadily over time, people basically dig a hole in the ground and bury themselves. The military doesn't want to see us do that. The military people I know these days are generals and lieutenant colonels. And those people seem to think that the best way to save money on warfare is to prevent warfare. The best way to cease to have to pay $200 a gallon, which is the delivery price for a gallon of gasoline in Afghanistan right now, not to mention the inestimable cost of human lives. The best way to save that is to put space solar power satellites up there and beam the energy directly down to your military units where you need them. And the best way to keep America from going down is to make America look up. So the military people I know want us to see things like the X-37B in order to lift our spirits and make sure we continue to be winners on stage after stage after stage of space exploration, from heavy lift vehicles to putting things in orbit to starting a space economy in orbit to leading. Buzz wants to America to be the leaders of international development of the moon. He says we've already been to the moon once. Going back there isn't a big deal. What is a big deal is working with Japan, working with Russia, working with India, and working with China to develop the moon, but taking the lead, because right now we have the lead. And then the next thing is Phobos in Buzz's vision. And actually, one of Buzz's most incredible ideas is something called the Aldrin Cycler. You put a vehicle up in space, you build it up in space, you don't ever need to bring it back down to Earth. And Buzz has worked out the celestial mechanics to put that thing on a permanent loop so that it goes around the Earth, then it goes to Mars, then it loops back without needing any fuel. Does it on gravity.
What a great idea.
So you want to go to Mars, George? I want to go to Mars. Okay, let's book a flight. We'll catch the shuttle, and the shuttle will take us from Earth orbit to Martian orbit.
Let's go to Houston, Texas. Ernest, you're up with us. Hi, Ernest.
I probably don't see his point of view, but, you know, in order to conquer space, I think we need to conquer the bottom of the ocean. You know, there's a lot of resources down there. And what's going on right now down here in the South is that, you know, hey, they can't even conquer to put a cap on this whale that's, you know, spilling millions of oil into the ocean.
Well,
so, maybe by that time they're going to need a rocket to get out of here because, hey, this thing is going to go up on a ball of flames.
Right. Well, Ernest, you know what you do when you're running a country and you're running a civilization. Look, we have the leading civilization in the world right now. We're being edged out very, very swiftly by China. We need to run very hard to stay ahead. And you develop all the resource bases that you can. So, yes, you develop the ocean bottom, but you become very aware of the fact that there are environmental consequences like the ones we're encountering right now in the Gulf of Mexico. Right now, one of the problems with that oil spill is the pressures at the bottom of the sea. The pressures a mile down in the sea are absolutely unbelievable. If you went out of a capsule, the reason there are no humans working down there is because the pressures would crush you down to the size of a softball in a second. And it is very difficult to work in that environment. Well, again, we have seen the environmental consequences right now of digging in the most extremes of the Earth. I think we have to dig in the extremes of the Earth. But the fact is, if we have a choice of drilling up and drilling down, drilling up produces far more benefit and far less damage.
Okay, let's go to Mike. We'll squeeze you in real quickly. Mike, driving in L.A. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I'm driving in the Aris Holocaust, all the chemtrails. So there is a secret black ops government operation going on. It's for VTRPE. And I encourage, George, all of your listeners to research chemtrails and geoengineering and what they are doing to our environment. They're spraying dispersants as well all over Louisiana, and the EPA has ordered them to stop, but it's such hypocrisy because they won't stop spraying Los Angeles on a daily basis. So I highly encourage all of your listeners to go to Facebook on Keep or Stop the Spraying, Geoengineering, Chemtrails, any of these web pages.
Well, they've been spraying us for a long, long time. Let's restrict this, though, tonight to our space program. Howard, just about a minute before the break, then we bring in Buzz Aldrin and talk about your relationship with him. We'll talk a little bit with him about his trip to the moon with Neil Armstrong and Michael Collins. What an event that must have been. I remember I had Buzz on about 4 years ago, and he was telling me that he had to use his pen to insert it in a switch in order to launch and come back to their command module.
Amazing. And he also invented EVA, that is extravehicular activities. He worked out all of the mechanics, the engineering for it. And he was the one who got who made sure that we had two men on the moon, not just one man on the moon. But you ask Buzz about his unified space vision, his vision for the future. That's his most important legacy.
All right. Will you stay with us? Howard Bloom, our special guest for the next 2 hours. Astronaut Buzz Aldrin will join us next hour. Toward the end of the hour, science advisor Richard C. Hoagland will join us. Richard stays then for the rest of the program. And Robert Zubrin joins us later on as well on Coast to Coast AM, as this is our space extravaganza on Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be right back. You know, for the second time this month, NASA's chief faced some tough talk on Capitol Hill from lawmakers as well as from Apollo moonwalkers Neil Armstrong, Gene Cernan, plus longtime aerospace executive Tom Young. Now, both the astronauts told members of Congress that returning humans to the moon was not only desirable but necessary for future exploration, even though NASA says it's no longer a priority. To some extent, the House Science and Technology Committee's hearing was a reprise of the Senate hearing earlier in the month, where Armstrong and Cernan played the starring roles. If anything, NASA Administrator Charles Bolden in the White House's revised exploration vision came in for even harsher scrutiny this time. In a moment, Buzz Aldrin, the second man to walk on the moon with Apollo 11, joins us along with Howard Bloom on Coast to Coast AM.
Contact light. Okay, engine stop. Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
And, of course, that's the Apollo 11 team of Neil Armstrong and Colonel Buzz Aldrin. And, of course, Michael Collins was up above in the command module. Buzz Aldrin, educated at West Point, graduated with honors in 1951. He flew Sabre jets in 66 combat missions in the Korean conflict. He earned his doctorate in astronautics from Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Manned Space Rendezvous. In 1963, Buzz was selected by NASA as one of the early astronauts. And, of course, as you know, the historic July 20th, 1969 landing on the moon. Truly an incredible moment. I remember there watching television with my dad at the age of 19 years old, watching that all happen. Here's Buzz Aldrin. He's been on the program before, and I had the honor of being with Buzz a little more than a year ago on Larry King's show as we were talking about life in space. Buzz, welcome back, my friend. How are you, Colonel?
I'm very good. Thank you very much. I really don't use my military rank much these days. The services hadn't seen fit to equalize us out a bit by elevating those military people who reached the moon. 22 people out of 24 to some higher
that is amazing.
Level rank.
Well, thank you for serving, by the way. And we've got Howard Bloom here. Mm-hmm. And Howard, thank you for bringing Buzz along and to talk about this important thing. And Howard was kidding that we were going to talk about just dancing with the stars, but we're not going to do that.
Well, you started your segment with some quotes. And my segment happened to be just taken from the checklist, whereas the other individuals expressed some kind of a longstanding communication. I wonder why you don't see fit to use the words magnificent desolation as a description of the magnificence of the human race, advancing to a point where they could build airplanes and fly in the sky and rockets and put people into orbit and then send people to be on the surface of the moon, and yet look out and see the most lifeless spot that I have ever seen or that any earthling has ever seen, something that hasn't changed in hundreds of thousands of years, a little bit more dust. But it's the most lifeless spot, very, very hot, going to very, very cold, 2 weeks of each, no air, nothing of life whatsoever. Why we think that that's a place that we should return to when robots can be controlled very nicely. We went there 40 years ago. I really failed to see where an advancing space power like we charted ourselves to become in the 60s and 70s, then after consolidating with a reusable large system to take things and people into orbit and then building a an unprecedented object in space called an International Space Station, neither of which really lived up to expectations.
Right.
But why do we feel we're exhibiting leadership by going back to the moon again?
Buzz, if you were running NASA today and you had a blank checkbook, what would you do? How would you develop the program?
Well, the Challenger accident occurred. The Columbia accident occurred on the 1st of February, 2003. And after 20 months of study, the NASA concluded, together with the White House, that something needed to be done differently. And so on the 14th of January, 2004, the president, without great fanfare, just out of NASA headquarters, put forth his vision for space exploration, which consisted of doing what the accident board said, which was to retire the space shuttle orbiter by the end of 2010. That's over 6 years away in January of 2004. And then hopefully have finished the space station by that time, design a new spacecraft by 2015, mm-hmm. and then land on the moon by 2020. Now, looking at it after having taken so long to get the shuttle going, almost 6 years without flying at all before the shuttle started flying, and then getting the space station going, not in 8 years for $8 billion with eight people, but $100 billion for six people. And we're trying to maintain six people there and not exactly on schedule. But anyway, we decided to go back to the moon because it looks as though the Indians and the Chinese and maybe others might want to do the same thing. Now, why would we really want to do that when it looks like, after close examination of the finances involved and the delays that have taken in executing this vision for space exploration, it looks as though we couldn't get to the moon until 2030, probably, or after, and the Chinese would be there to welcome us.
That's true.
Now, is this exactly what we should inspire our young people with? And I don't want to stop there. We've got a gap right now that looks like it's 5 to 7 years before, while we have to use the Russians to fly to our space station in a Soyuz spacecraft that is not all that safe. And after that, the spacecraft that NASA has been studying in this Constellation program would splash down back in the ocean again. After 30 years of landing nicely on a runway, we're going to go back after flying with the Russians to our space station and splash down in the ocean. That's not
we're going
the
backwards.
Country that I went to the moon for.
We're going backwards, Buzz. And that's a shame. We're going to lose that advantage we had?
There's a simple explanation for it.
And what would that be?
The accident board said, separate crew and cargo. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, that was probably a good idea, but putting crew and cargo together in the shuttle enabled us to deploy satellites, to bring other satellites back, to take the Hubble telescope up there, and then to get it ready, deploy it, then go visit it several times and service it. It enabled us to go to other space stations, the Mir space station, then begin to build our own space station chunk by chunk over a long period of time. That was all possible because we had crew and cargo together. Not that safe, because you can't abort and get off of the launch vehicle very fast when you have to carry all that cargo with you inside the orbiter. So it was a wise decision to say separate crew and cargo in the spacecraft. But they added a phrase, on the launch vehicle. Now, this opened the door for a study that had been taking place that I was aware of that was going to put a crew on one solid rocket and then put the lander and everything else on a bigger, much bigger rocket, build two rockets that were quite a bit different from what had been launching the shuttle. And I complained to the president of the accident board, an admiral, and an admiral who was in charge of NASA exploration. Well, nothing happened. They listened to me. That's fine. But then the new administrator to NASA went ahead and did exactly what he had studied before. He charted a program with an Ares 1 rocket and an Ares 5 rocket. Now, the smaller one began quickly to not be enough for the growing weight of the spacecraft that was going to land in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So it had to be improved, upgraded significantly, and it didn't even have enough fuel, as Apollo did, to have the command module put the command module and the lander into lunar orbit. It didn't have enough fuel to do that, so they had to put the fuel in the lander, which made it monstrous size and made the big rocket even bigger. Now, we ran into troubles, and it's obvious we were not going to have a spacecraft ready by the time the orbiter was going to be retired. No matter how much money you put into it, and this is not a good time to be pumping extra money, the president's budget does put some extra money in, not as much as the Augustine Commission advised that they do. But why in the world would we not want to terminate this Ares 1, Ares 5 rocket, save money, and then as long as we're going to build a new set of rockets, let's retire the orbiter? Now, a year ago, I felt it was a good idea maybe to stretch out some of the orbiter missions. That was when there were at least five flights left. Well, we didn't do that. And now there are only two, and it's too late to stretch out the shuttle flights to make any meaningful impact on the 5 to 7 year delay.
And the thought was of not having a vehicle or a craft to be able to take astronauts into space for God knows how long is
yeah, but we did have them.
But we did, exactly.
We did study the orbital space plane with a Boeing runway landing craft on top of a Boeing rocket and a Lockheed runway landing craft on top of a Lockheed rocket. But we canceled those programs along with another even better solution that my company had. But the answer to that was, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to go back to the moon with two rockets instead of one and build a spacecraft that won't land on a runway. It'll land in the ocean.
Buzz, why don't they have the plan? It doesn't seem that difficult to come up with a great plan to get us back into space. Why aren't they doing it?
There was a spacecraft that was a derivative of a Russian spacecraft 20, 25 years ago that was fished out of the ocean after it made subscale flights into orbit. We re-engineered it at Langley Research Center and studied it for at least 8 years, $800 million, a lot of wind tunnel tests. It is considered by most people that I talk to as the best spacecraft that we could build, and internationals could lease it from us, and it's a lifting body, and it lands on a runway, and we could have had that by now.
Oh, sure.
But we don't have it now. But all we want to talk about is landing in the ocean after flying with the Russians. That's not the kind of program that I want to see out of keeping the course, staying the course with the Constellation program, or saying, well, let's just fly the shuttle for another 5 years. It's kind of too late to do that.
And this plan to go to an asteroid and maybe eventually get to Mars... And I like your idea, by the way, of going to Phobos.
Well, I set a plan in motion that I believe could have put us landing a habitat on Phobos in the fall of 2022. Then we could man it with three people for a year and a half in 2025, 27, and 29, and then we could land on the surface of Mars in 2031. Now, I'll give you two more periods of two more possible launch periods.
Sure.
and say we ought to get there by 2025. I'm sorry, 2035.
Those years are going to come up awfully fast, too.
Well, but what is 2035? Well, it happens to be 66 years from when we landed on the moon.
That's amazing.
Okay?
Yeah.
That's not very, that's not a lot of progress from landing on the moon to now landing on Mars permanently, 66 years. You know what we did in 66 years before going to the moon? That's the Wright brothers.
Yeah.
1903.
Yeah, look at that.
1969.
Yeah.
Look at what we did.
Yeah.
And we're saying that progression is kind of natural logarithmic growth.
Not
in the United States.
And maybe with computers, but not with the space program. That's for sure. And it's got to be frustrating for so many people who have been involved in this incredible space program where we were light years ahead of everybody else, not to see it advance. Will it be turned around? That's the question, Buzz. Will it be turned around?
I don't think there has been a more crucial time for our space program, or a more opportunistic time to really set the course correct, to commit to a 25-year program, but not just a straight progression for 25 years. It's a two-phase program. We study for 10 years to see that we're doing the right thing. We develop the things that are needed. Then at the end of 10 years, you know what happens then? That's the 50th anniversary of landing on the moon. Be a lot of attention played.
Absolutely.
Whoever's the president then, all he has to do is to reaffirm we're on the right path, the path to permanence at Mars in the next 15 years. That's doable, and that will be historic.
Buzz, I want to talk after we come back from the break about your unified space vision. And Howard,
sure,
with just about 2 minutes here to go before we hit the break.
Okay.
I like Buzz's program, Howard.
And I think it's doable, and I think we can start doing it now, and I think we can close this space gap. I heard a shudder go through Buzz's heart when he was thinking about the fact that the shuttle would be retired, and there would be a 5-year to 7-year space gap when Americans could not get into space,
yep,
with their own rockets.
At least that long.
And that shudder went through me, and George, I can tell that shudder went through you too. And it's, we can overcome this, but we have to put our eyes on the target and push ahead as rapidly as possible. I believe that can be done within the confines of the president's space program.
This Unified Space Vision program that Buzz has developed, is it getting some ears on Congress, Buzz? Are they listening to you?
Well, I briefed a group of Democrat senators, about 20, 24 of them, a good number, over a year ago. Then I briefed a group of Republican House members. And then I presented my ideas to the Augustine Commission in June, I guess it was, of last year. Then a little later on, based on that, I was asked to present these ideas to the Office of Science, Technology, Policy and the Bureau of the Budget. But a friend of mine in the National Security Council said, well, if you're going to do that, I'd like it to be on my turf. So he arranged for the briefing to take place to the three major organizations, the Bureau of the Budget, the Technology Policy Office, and the National Security Council in the White House, at the White House security, at the Situation Room of the White House.
Hey, Buzz, we're going to take this quick break. We'll be back with you and Howard Bloom in just a moment. When I was on Larry King's show, I didn't have an opportunity to wish Buzz a happy birthday, by the way. In January, he turned 80 years old. We'll be back in a moment with Buzz Aldrin and Howard Bloom on Coast to Coast AM. And we're back with Buzz Aldrin and Howard Bloom this hour. Buzz, I'll get right back into the space program here, but you did do a great job with Dancing with the Stars. I got to congratulate you. Was it fun?
It was quite a challenge, and I accepted that challenge really for the same reason that that someone talked me into participating in a rap song called The Rocket Experience. With the harmony by two ladies in my office, my secretary and my stepdaughter, and they wrote the music, and we had a little bit of instruction by Snoop Dogg and Quali, and endorsement, of course, by my good friend Quincy Jones.
Oh, that's great!
And that was quite popular, and people were surprised that I would do that. But the purpose of it and of doing the Dancing with the Stars was to use my recognition with the Apollo program 40 years ago to remind people of the great successes that this country had with landing 6 out of 7 times in the 60s and 70s, and to have them think about the space program of the future and consider possibly that my dedication to the space program would give me the benefit of a few sound ideas that that could benefit our future.
It was an amazing time, Buzz. You were 39 when you landed on the moon. I was 19 when I was watching you. And I've got to tell you, even though it was a tough time for this country, you know, we were going through Vietnam and everything else and the racial strife that was happening, it was the space program that I think Howard Bloom kept this nation together, don't you?
Absolutely. Again, it's back to a nation that looks up, goes up. And another thing that Buzz, poor Buzz had to listen to me talk about this one day. Every day, even when you're 80 years old, every day is the first day of the most important 20 years of your life. That's true whether you're Buzz, who's been plowing new territory with rap and Dancing with the Stars,
I love it,
or
yeah,
whether it's a nation. And right now, the big element that's missing from our conversation right now is something in the president's program called a space taxi, because we know the long-term mission is Mars. We know that Phobos will get us to Mars. We know that those Aldrin cyclers will allow us to shuttle back and forth like commuters to Mars. It'll take a little bit longer than your normal morning commute, but it will be a regular service. What's missing is what we do right now, and that's where the concept of the space taxi comes in. That's where Elon Musk, I think, is our great hope right now, because Elon, in addition to the Dragon 9 Heavy that we were talking about, has a Dragon capsule. But as Buzz pointed out, a capsule's a backward-looking proposition. What we really need is what Buzz has been talking about, something, a lander that can go up the way the space shuttle does and come back down and land the way the X-37B does. And there's a mystery about exactly what a space taxi is. And I'm not quite sure, but we need it fast, whatever it is. Also, you've got to remember that Armadillo is working on this. Armadillo is John I can never remember John's last name.
Carmack.
Yeah, Carmack. And John Carmack is the inventor of Doom. And John Carmack is apparently making interesting progress. And at ISDC, the International Space Development Conference, at the end of this week, just in a few days, John Carmack is, I believe, going to make some sort of major announcement. In addition, we've got Jeff Bezos, who is the head of the founder of Amazon, and he has been very, very quietly putting his money into the resurrection of a space plane that would take off and land on its own, that can take off vertically and land vertically. I believe it's called the DCX. Buzz would know that better than I would. So there are moves going on in the private community to fill in this space gap.
I was going to say, Buzz, can the private sector make money going into space eventually, do you think?
Well, I think that's questionable. Certainly, if your customer is NASA and you're taking people up to the space station, it's a question of what is the value of that transportation up to the space station. Now, the shuttle has taken people up there, but it's a very expensive machine. And keeping it going has really taken up a good bit of our budget capability. I think that when we allow the private sector to have well-engineered spacecraft, spacecraft that have been really looked at for quite a while, supervised in its development, and brought to operating condition, that I feel the private sector can certainly execute continued operation, again, under the supervision of the FAA, Federal Aviation Administration, and other organizations responsible for the safe operation of transportation vehicles. I certainly believe that that can happen. Now, is it possible to take companies that have not done this before and can deliver cargo up there to the space station and pass certain restrictions as to how they approach the space station? Can we really entrust them to, say, right from the beginning, when they get through their test missions, which should be rather extensive, can we really trust them to be able to do it on their own? I think they're going to need significant oversight and supervision, and it's only prudent, since we're dealing with a transportation system for the government, that it be supervised in some appropriate way by the government. I think it's debatable, but I certainly think that a spacecraft that's been studied so much by the government as this HL-20 and done the wind tunnel test and comes back and lands on a runway, that it certainly is the kind of thing that can be overseen and perhaps partnered by a major corporation in addition to the more of a startup, Sierra Nevada, who is handling the development of that spacecraft right now.
That is going to be an intriguing moment when we get to that point, because I think you're right. If they have good clients like NASA, then they could probably make some money. In the meantime, the other countries like India and China seem to be coming along even faster than Russia. Is that a pretty accurate assessment, Buzz?
Well, the Chinese received a large amount of consultation and copying of the Soyuz spacecraft and a number of other things, whether they appropriately compensated Russia for that, was raised by a number of cosmonauts that I know, but I'm not sure of the validity of that. But certainly the industrial system, the technology system that China has evolved into is quite capable of putting humans into space. And to be able to send them rather easily on a circumlunar flight well before the U.S. could ever land people on the moon with our own developments. And that certainly would allow the Chinese to say, oh, look, we're obviously going to be supreme in the 21st century. Look, America can't even get back to the moon like they did before. And here we're able to beat them. And they could certainly land one person for one day, and it would be a tremendous occasion for the Chinese to do that.
Buzz, we've got you and Howard for about 10 more minutes, and I wanted to bring in our show's science advisor, Richard Hoagland, who was a former NASA consultant and also worked a lot with Walter Cronkite in his day during the Apollo missions as well. And he wanted to chat with both of you while we had a few moments remaining. Richard, welcome. Thank you, Richard, for picking up the gauntlet and joining us for the rest of the night.
Well, it's certainly my pleasure. First of all, Mr. Aldrin, should I call you Colonel or should I call you General? I think you're absolutely right. I think it's an absolute disgrace that this country, this nation, has not amply acknowledged your service and those of the other military astronauts who have served faithfully in NASA and elevated you in rank. And I will remind you that John Kennedy reinstated Dr. Oppenheimer's security clearance over the loud protestations of a lot of his administration and Republican critics, and I would hope that President Obama would get a copy of the show tonight and would do the right thing and give you all the appropriate promotions that you deserve.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. It's not going to cost the government anything. It's a question of prestige in this country somewhat, even though a lot of people don't regard the military very highly in this country. But it would mean an awful lot to the international nations, and even more than that, to take the 24 people who reached the moon and give them the full State Department rank of lunar ambassador, carrying the title, the approved title of the honorable. That's something that impresses other nations that 18 of us are still alive that reached the moon. And some of those lunar ambassadors can help the Washington representatives of the space agencies that are planning on going back to the moon, as what the nation, what our nation should do is to set up, with our experience, an international lunar development corporation. And we have more experience at the moon, so we would be leaders in that, but not with our rockets and our spacecraft and our people. It's time that maybe China build the base on the moon that the rest of the countries can use. And one way to start that is to bring China and India and Brazil and South Korea in as partners in the International Space Station.
You know, however, as a patriotic American, and obviously you are too, there's something that bothers me that the nation that first set boot prints on the moon, yours and Neil's, should take a backseat to anyone in developing in the 21st century the development of the solar system. I mean, one of my old friends who is no longer with us is a guy that I'm sure you talked with many times, Kraft Ehrke. And Kraft Ehrke came over here from Germany along with von Braun and many others, and he worked at General Dynamics. And then in his later years, he was looking at the long term. This was just at the time that you and Neil were landing. And he wrote a book which actually took off from your famous and absolutely immortal phrase, Magnificent Desolation. And he talked about the magnificent heritage. He termed the solar system and its resources the magnificent heritage. But what's happened in the last 40 years? We've really, you know, been piddling around at the edges of this cosmic ocean, to use another term from President Kennedy, and we haven't done any of the amazing things that I thought the night that you were walking around on the moon and I was watching you on a little black and white TV at North American Rockwell with Robert Heinlein, who I had picked as one of our guests in our CBS lineup for Walter. We're watching you, you know, gallivanting around, or watching you do that center of gravity thing that you were describing as you were doing it, and I was nudging Robert, and he was nudging me, and he was telling me things like, he says, Richard, he said, this is going to be day one, year one of the next phase of development of the entire human race. And here we are 40 years later tonight, and we're talking about turning the United States into a third-rate nation and allowing China and India and Japan to develop the resources that we pioneered in terms of your mission. I'm not sure I like the sound of that, and I don't think this audience does either. And this Coast audience, if it gets behind some of your ideas, Buzz, They could literally change night to day. We have more listeners listening to you right now all over the world than all of NASA television ever has watching any mission. And this audience is politically astute. They know, because they've asked NASA to do things before, that when they ask in enough numbers, things happen. I would like you to take a couple of minutes and address the political situation and where this audience could put their mettle, put their intention, put their support that would really make a difference in this critical next couple of months in terms of the Congress and the administration.
What would you like us to do, Buzz, because this audience can deliver?
Well, I certainly wouldn't go and repeat what we did in 1963, 1964, 1965, 1966, 1967, and plan on going back to the moon, and after putting $100 billion of our money into the International Space Station, put billions of dollars into an international base of some sort or a national base on the moon. What are the resources that we are going to bring back that can possibly pay for the cost that it takes to do that?
Well,
there are resources at asteroids that are far easier to bring back. Sure, it takes a little longer to get there, but they're easier to get than to kick up the lunar dust looking for some of the minerals that might be there on the moon. Now, sure, there may be water there, and what good is water if you're not going to grow things for humans to eat? If you're not going to send humans there, is water good for something? Yes. You can put it into oxygen and hydrogen, and as fuel for spacecraft to do what? To go back to the moon. So you go to the moon to get oxygen, to go to the moon to get oxygen, to go to the moon to get oxygen. Where's the payoff back at Earth? We still don't have something except a bunch of people who mine the surface. Now, wouldn't it be a good idea to find out the value of refueling oxygen and hydrogen that comes from the Earth into fuel depots in orbit around the Earth and close to the moon? That's what I think we should do, develop refueling depots mm-hmm. based on Earth propellants and case for that. Before we launch off and start mining the moon to produce fuel that is probably more expensive in the long run than we could have produced from the Earth.
One of the major problems that I think some of your colleagues have, like Neil and Gene and others, and they were expressed today in the House hearings over on Capitol Hill, was that the current Obama proposal, the proposal that you have gotten behind, is missing a key component. And I don't understand, you know, and I really would like you to educate me, how can we expect in a nation where anything that's beyond its service life is looked at as old and ancient and you know, not new and not current and not hip and all that, how can we imagine that Americans will be satisfied to quietly work on research and development in the back room for 10 years, taking NASA back to its old NACA days, when they're constantly looking for something on television that is inspiring the current generation to want to be better and, as Howard said, reach higher? In other words, isn't the fatal flaw in the Obama plan that there's no time, there's no goal, there's no timetable for developing the extraordinary things that you and I obviously certainly agree on, that we need to be looking at Mars, we need to be looking at Phobos, we need to be looking at the outer solar system, not just the moon? But without some kind of a doable timetable where you have benchmarks where people can see, okay, we've done this, we can do that, the technology's developed now, we can reach out further. Without those timetables, how do you keep a program going that is sustained over an entire generation?
Well, Richard, let me jump. Point, Buzz does have a unified space program. It does have a timetable. We've been working very hard to visualize it so that you can see it all in one picture. And what I would suggest as an immediate step is that we could get, Buzz could probably get this finished within 2 days, and we could get it to George, and we could get it put up on the Coast to Coast website.
Absolutely.
And at least it would provide a skeletal model of where we can go. If people want to piddle with it and make minor changes, that's good.
but you need to start somewhere, and this is a picture that everybody can grasp, and it's your timetable, Richard.
Howard, we're out of time. I want to thank you for spending the time with me, and Buzz, thank you. You're welcome back anytime, sir, anytime. And Richard, of course, you will be with me for the rest of the program, along with Bob Zubrin joining us next hour as well. I mean, I still get chills, Richard, when I talk to an astronaut, as I do with Edgar Mitchell, who comes on quite a bit, knowing that they were on the moon. Isn't that a fascinating feeling?
Well, it's both fascinating, and I certainly feel for Buzz, and this nation has not appropriately recognized in a way that would encourage participation by other nations. I think this idea of honorable lunar ambassadors and giving them their appropriate military promotions is the least we can do to acknowledge the extraordinary service of these heroes as we both look back and look forward.
Our space extravaganza continues with Richard Hoagland and Robert Zubrin in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, let me introduce Robert Zubrin for you. You already know Richard Hoagland. Robert Zubrin is the inventor of several unique concepts for space propulsion and exploration. As an engineer at Lockheed Martin, he co-developed the Mars Direct Plan for affordable manned Mars missions. Most recently, he founded the Mars Society, which is an international organization dedicated to furthering the exploration and settlement of Mars by both public and private means. I'm looking forward to hearing Richard talk with Robert, too, about Mars exploration. Here's Robert Zubrin, regular on Coast to Coast. Robert, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you, George?
Good to have you with us. And Richard's over here on the other side there. Richard?
Hi, Robert.
Hi, Richard.
Before we, George, before we get into Robert, let me raise one point.
Okay.
I think we need this audience to do something tonight before they forget. They need to send an email to the White House. Go to Google whitehouse.gov, and you'll get the actual email address.
Right.
In fact, if you go to the White House website, you can find a niche where they have specific emails for the president, and we know he reads them. We need a lot of people in this audience tonight who believe in space, who understand the complexities of politics and the idea of face and presentation, and as Buzz said, the impact this would have on the international community. We need them to lobby, I'll use that word, lobby strenuously to make Buzz Aldrin, Neil Armstrong, and the other surviving Apollo-era astronauts who went to the moon honorable, honorary lunar ambassadors. And I presume that there is more information on Buzz Aldrin's site regarding this. If there isn't, I will, you know, privately contact them, and I will get it, and I'll put it on our website. I'll put it on Coast. But I think this is something that Buzz was trying to tell us.
Well, and a rank increase. They deserve that.
A rank increase. He should definitely be a general. And all of the appropriate military services should be looked at in terms of the promotions that these guys overwhelmingly – I mean, look, what more courageous act can a human being, you know, deliver to its country than to get on top of the equivalent of a nuclear bomb and go a half a million miles to an alien planet and come home safely and represent this nation proudly around this planet for the last 40 years. So those two things, I think, are critically important. This president can do it with an executive order, a dash of his pen. He can do it tomorrow, although he's kind of busy with the golf thing right now. But if we start this campaign, this Coast audience, I think, can make a critical difference in the lead up to the things that you and I and Bob are going to talk about in the next couple hours.
Absolutely. And Robert, we've talked to Richard about his views on this initiative, this Obama plan. I want to get your take on it. You know, Armstrong, Cernan, they're not happy with the president's plan. Aldrin seems to support it. What are your thoughts on this, Robert?
I'm not happy with it. It's not genuine. He called for sending astronauts to an asteroid by 2025 while eliminating all the programs that would have made it possible to do that. And we could easily do it by 2015 if he hadn't killed the programs that he did, the heavy lift booster, the Orion capsule. Then he talks about going to Mars by 2040. Well, that's putting it at such a distant date that he doesn't actually have to do anything towards that goal. So it's basically a plan to do nothing. And essentially, under the Obama plan, we have this show 10 years from now. We'll be no closer than to sending humans to Mars than we are today.
Yeah, we'll be talking about the space program and why we're not there yet.
Right.
How sad that will be. Richard, you have, in some respects, echoed exactly what Robert has been telling us.
Absolutely. I'm astonished, you know. Well, actually not, because Robert's a good engineer.
You two see eye to eye on a lot of things.
You know, he's a good tactician. He has proposed a plan called Mars Direct that I thought was spiffy and cool and neat and doable for the last, how long is it, 15 years, Robert?
Since 1990.
The problem is, and I'm going to make this statement very flatly tonight, I think President Barack Obama, like on the Gulf, which is a situation out of control tonight, I think President Obama has been getting abominable advice about what to do with NASA and the National Space Program. For a guy who keeps extolling the vision of President John Kennedy, and that he sat on the shoulders of his grandfather and watched the Apollo astronauts come ashore in their practices out in Hawaii, for him to enunciate a program which, as I tried to get into with Colonel Aldrin and wasn't really able to because of time, nothing ever succeeds unless there is a goal, a timetable, and adequate funding. And we don't have any of those for this proposed so-called Obama budget. And I think it's not Obama's budget. I think he is taking the advice, particularly of John Holdren, who frankly I don't think understands civilization.
Well, this is the same guy who
recommend what he's recommending.
That's the same guy who wants to reduce civilization.
Yes, he was a protege. He was a student of Paul Ehrlich. Remember the population bomb?
Yeah.
We were going to be up to our hips in bodies by now. This Malthusian idea that you can sustain civilization by staying on one planet and not, as Buzz and Kraft Erica and I and Robert and you and a lot of other people who think about this understand, you must open the system. You must go from a closed system to an open system. Joseph Farrell's latest book, Babylon Banksters, is part and parcel of how that's gotten us into terrible trouble with the banking and the whole financial mess and morass that we're in. Because unless you are dealing with an open system, civilization comes to an end. I don't care whether it's the U.S. or China or Russia or India. We are the nation of the frontier. And Robert has written, at least two books, right, with this as the theme. The thing that made the United States of America was, A, all that land that Howard Bloom talked about that we acquired during the Mexican War, and B, the creation of a national railway system, which was done again by land grants and federal oversight and basically lifting the corporate sector up by its bootstraps, those early railroad guys who didn't want to really have a lot of their own money, so they relied on the feds to help them, which the feds did, and it created the United States of America. Well, in the same way, we are in a position, as Buzz said appropriately, we are at this dividing moment. We are at this moment in history where the decisions we make in the next few months will decide the fate of civilization, literally, as if it needs any you know, less help than we're already not giving it. But those decisions will redound to our detriment and will reduce the United States to a third world nation in less than that decade, by the 50th anniversary of the landing of the United States on the moon, in the persona of Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong, people will be saying, United States of what? Because history is accelerating at that rate, and if we're not leading, we're not going to be in a position just to follow. We will not even be in the game, in the conversation. So, hey, yes,
let me jump in here.
Exactly the same page tonight on this.
Go ahead,
okay.
Robert.
Yeah. One of the points that Richard made here is really important, and that is this Malthusian thing. It is the antithesis of progress, and it's the antithesis of freedom. In fact, it's a justification for tyranny. The basic conceit comes down to this. There isn't enough to go around. Therefore, human aspirations must be crushed. Therefore, authorities must be constituted capable of crushing human aspiration. That's the basic idea.
If you're limited to one planet.
Yes. Now, but it's, see, you know, so this goes back a long time, and it was the justification for making the Irish starve during the famine. It was the justification for Nazism. It is, you can get people to accept anything if you can get them to accept this idea that there isn't enough to go around. And the what the Malthusians need to do, though, in order to put this across is get people to accept that. They have to create a prison of the mind. They have to get people to think that there is only so much, and therefore every person is fundamentally the enemy of every other person, and the aspiration of these other people must be crushed, and your aspirations must be limited, and that's the only way it can be. And this space program undermines the walls of the prisons of the mind, because if we are expanding into space, then people say, well, wait a second, there are no limits to growth. Okay, none of this is true. You know, we don't have to accept this. We don't have to accept a future in which there's a closing circle of possibilities, and we need a government and enforcers to get people to accept that. And so, in other words, this is something – how people conceive of the future is important long before that future comes. It's not a question of us needing resources from Mars or asteroids or something anytime soon. For the moment, there's plenty of stuff around here on Earth. It's how we think about the future.
Right.
Okay? And because if you think about the future as a closed future, a future with no open frontier, then you say, well, there's only so much, we better start limiting our appetites now. We better start limiting our hopes now. And those people who aren't willing to do that need to be made to do that. And we must have governmental authorities capable of doing that. And, I mean, look, these people were talking this – well, actually, Malthus was talking this back in 1800, that there's only so much to go around. Well, the world population has multiplied six times over since then, and everybody is doing a lot better than they were then.
And what's the one reason they are, Robert?
Advance the technology.
Technology, precisely.
Right. And now
right
here you have Holdren, who is a protege, as Richard said, of Paul Ehrlich, who's an arch-Malthusian, who said, that the United States government should impose forced sterilization programs on the entire Third World. He wrote this in 1968.
Yep, that was his plan.
Okay, and not only that, that there should be set up within the United States a Bureau of Population and Environment to whom Americans would have to apply to for permits if they wanted to have children.
Yes. Sounds like
interesting is that Holdren and his his mentor, which was Paul Ehrlich, obviously have not read history correctly, because history shows us, and Robert, correct me if I'm wrong, but it shows us that any society that uses technology and uses it to make people richer, individual men and women richer, the birth rate falls, the average income rises, people become worthy of living lives worthy of living, and the population limits, that population bomb that Ehrlich, was warning us about, just quietly goes away in the enhancement of the lifestyle and the living standards of ordinary men and women. That's not what's in the president's plan for NASA by way of John Holdren. So if we want to nominate a bad guy tonight, my nomination, it's not President Obama. It is, in fact, the advice he is getting, which is the most abysmal, abominable, backward, let's go back to the future kind of advice you could imagine a president getting at a critical time in history when what's going on in the Gulf is showing us tonight we cannot keep doing the same old thing we've been doing, and expect a different result.
But he's getting that kind of advice in every sector of his administration.
Yes.
Right. But that's the thing. That's what this whole global warming thing is. Okay? In other words, instead of it's a variant on the Malthusian theory. In other words, instead of saying we're running out of resources, it's saying we've run out of the right to use resources. Either way, you know, the development of the third world must be stopped. Billions of people are going to have to live in poverty and starve to death because this is the way it has to be. And I have to say, look, you know, the Malthusian theory is wrong as a theory, and so what Richard just said is completely correct, that is, it's scientifically false. But it does serve powerfully as a basis for justifying tyrannical measures and the crushing of human aspirations. It serves as the basis, essentially, of the policies of Nazi Germany. And, you know, they were successful in getting a civilized nation to agree that the population of Eastern Europe had to be eliminated because there was only enough living space for the Germans. And the you know, when Germany wasn't overpopulated, it's not overpopulated today. And you know, with less living space than it had in the 30s. It's a false theory, but it is a powerful justification for evil policy.
And evil policy follows, and people jump aboard.
Well, remember, politics is 90%, if not 99%, perception. If you can control the dialogue, if you can channel human thought, so that there is no out of the box thinking allowed. If you make people toe the line and keep running into them, it's scarce, it's limited, it's finite. We can't use it all up when, of course, you're sitting in a solar system filled with unimaginable riches.
Right.
That's why I see a glimmer of possibility in Obama's plan, because the part of it that's good, which is trying to move things into a private, commercial, competitive operation where people actually compete for the riches that are out there, that's the good part.
See, I don't even see it as a plan, though, Richard. I don't think they have a plan.
Well, you can't plan as a centralized planning for free enterprise.
But they're not doing anything. I mean, this is – George is right. It's not even a plan. I had problems with the Griffin, you know, the Bush administration plan. I thought it was the wrong plan,
but at least
it was a plan. This isn't a plan,
Robert, as Richard said about a bad idea,
this is not even wrong.
The problem is the Bush plan was such a bad plan, it makes certain people think the Obama plan is a good plan, by contrast. And what everyone is missing, and I didn't have time to really bring it up with Buzz, but without a timetable and a goal, any backroom technology tinkering and toys you develop will never reach the front room.
Richard, why have most astronauts not endorsed this quote-unquote plan?
For the reason that he just said.
Dumb.
It's absolutely
stupid. Yeah. Can I be any plainer, George?
And they know it.
It does not work, and it will not work, and it is designed, I believe it is designed by Holdren.
Not to work.
Not to work and to kill the leadership of the United States of America in the next decade.
We're going to continue with Robert Zubrin and Richard Hoagland in just a moment. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with both of them. Robert's website, he's got a couple, linked up at coasttocoastam.com, marssociety.org, energyvictory.net. Yes, he has done a lot of work about breaking free of oil, by the way. So you might want to take a look at both of those. And Richard C. Hoagland, of course. His website is enterprisemission.com. He's got an upcoming speaking event, by the way, with Stephen Greer in a few months, and I'll have him talk about that, too, when we come back. You know, Robert Zubrin, I had given Buzz a blank check to run NASA. I'm giving it to you when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, I'm going to hand you a blank check. Can you do anything you want with it for NASA's budget? What are you going to do?
I'm going to make our goal to send humans to Mars by the end of this decade, and that's what we do. The only time NASA has ever functions effectively is when, as Richard said, it has a concrete goal, a concrete schedule, that organizes its efforts and can get the job done. That's actually why the robotic program is effective, because it has concrete missions. It's mission-driven. And that's what how the manned program has to be. And it's not humans to Mars in the year 2040 or 3040 or 4040, but humans to Mars before this decade is out. And we can certainly do that. We're much closer today to being able to send humans to Mars than we were to being able to send men to the moon in 1961, and we were there 8 years later. We could be on Mars in 8 years if we were serious.
With old technology. Richard, I'm going to give you the blank check. What are you going to do?
Well, we don't need a blank check. I mean, everybody is very concerned now, justifiably so, about funding and money and taxes, and they all think we all pay too much and it's all being wasted. I mean, we spent as a nation, as a people, in the last year alone, well, year and a half, from the last half year of the Bush administration through the first year of the Obama administration, we have spent, between the outright bank bailouts and the secret Fed deals behind the scenes, something on the order of $24 trillion. That's $24 trillion. If you stacked up dollar bills, one on top of the other, little flat, little dollar bills, you could climb to the moon on $24 trillion. Now, we don't need anywhere near that amount of money as a civilization, as a culture, to have a space program worthy of the name. But what I think we need to do, and again, I'm sorry I didn't have a chance to ask Colonel Aldrin this, what he felt an appropriate level of funding, annual assured funding, for NASA should be to leave the United States and the world into the 21st century of solar system development. But it sure as hell is a lot less than $24 trillion. In fact, for the current budget, which is about $19
billion, which the budget to be is $6 billion more than what we have now.
Well, that's over
right?
5 years.
Over 5 years.
You know, the budget now is under something like 18, and I think the current budget proposal for 2011, Robert, is like 19 and change.
Right. And, you know, here's the thing. Do you know what NASA's average budget in today's dollars were between 1961 and 1973? That is when we went from zero space capability to flying to the moon and building the Skylab space station and doing a raft of lunar and interplanetary probes.
About what it is now.
Exactly what it is now. Okay, $19 billion a year.
Amazing.
The problem is it's not money. You know, as you said, you give me a blank check. I don't need a blank check in terms of cash. The current budget would do a little more. It'd be nice, but it doesn't have to be significantly more. We could do it with the amount of money we're using now, but what we need is a concrete goal. That's the thing that's so ironic about this Obama plan. I mean, I could understand it if he was taking a position which many liberals have taken in the past, which is the money should be spent here on Earth on various social programs, and so we should cut NASA's budget. No, they're increasing NASA's budget, but they're spending it on nothing. They're rebuilding the shuttle launch pads after the shuttle program stopped.
That doesn't make sense.
Okay, they're developing electric thrusters without power sources to drive them.
Hold on, they're really rebuilding the launch pads after they would have stopped the shuttles?
Correct. The shuttle launch pads are what are going to be used on 39A and B to launch the next generation of private commercial spaceflight.
Excuse me. The shuttle launch pads are designed for vehicles that can have 7.5 million pounds of thrust, which is the same thrust as a Saturn V. They don't need that for little private launch vehicles. They've got plenty of launch pads already that can launch medium lift launch vehicles.
What I'm pointing out is that's what they're proposing to do.
Let me go on here, because this is outrageous stuff. They're talking about spending $3 billion a year on the space station program during the years 2015, 16, 17, 18, when we're not launching anything to the space station under the current plan, and we're not building any new modules for it. So what is $3 billion a year going for? I mean, that's a lot of tang. I mean, $3 billion a year is enough to hire 30,000 people and pay them $100,000 a year each. Okay, they're spending money all over the place, but to accomplish nothing. And that is the incredible thing about this plan.
I think that's what Holden's plan is.
Yes,
spend a
it's
lot
designed
of money
to fail and fail badly.
To give the illusion that we're spending money on the prestigious diamond in the setting, which is NASA, but not really doing anything that will advance us anywhere in any reasonable time frame.
It's gelding NASA is what it's doing.
That's what it's doing, yes.
It's giving NASA money but not allowing it to run. So it just is kept in the stable. It gets fatter and fatter and uglier and uglier. And then eventually someone will slaughter it because they say, what can we do with this? Okay.
Right. Can I finish the answer to George's question?
Yeah.
You know, you got a shot at being NASA administrator. Let me have my shot here.
Mm-hmm.
Within the current budget, what we should do is, in fact, exactly what Buzz Aldrin is recommending that we do, except that part of his proposal doesn't get much attention. Let me read to you from a white paper that apparently he wrote in the last few days called The Way Forward, Achieving a Consensus on America's Future in Space. I'm not quite sure where this appears, but it was sent to me by one of my sources this afternoon.
I was going to say, where'd you get this?
It came from me from an inside source, you know, in NASA. So let me read to you the most interesting part, which is, he says, I think I might have lost it here. Oh, darn.
You're going to lose your spot. I'm going to go to Zubrin now.
I'll go to Zubrin.
All right.
I'll come back in a second.
Robert, what about the moon? You haven't said anything about the moon.
Well, look, you know, the Bush plan was to return to the moon, and that was the wrong plan. The idea that NASA's goal should be to return to the moon a half century after it was there the first time, it was less than worthy of NASA. But it certainly, though, was a better plan than to accomplish nothing in the next 10 years, which is what the Obama plan is.
Okay, I found it.
Okay, so yeah, I thought the Bush plan was certainly worthy of criticism, and they set themselves up for a fall by proposing a plan that had so little public support, so little rationality, so little ability to inspire people, return to the moon. When Obama canceled it, not many people stepped forward to defend it. But what he replaced it with was worse. I mean, at least under the Bush plan, we would have developed a heavy lift vehicle, the RH-5, which we could have used to go to Mars with. And we would have developed other major hardware elements that would have been useful for going to Mars.
The problem is it was not affordable in terms of NASA's so-called budget. Now,
well, actually, that's just not true. That was a statement made by the Augustine Commission, and those people were just liars. They were incredible liars.
Why don't you tell us how you really feel, Bob?
Okay. I'm sorry for disguising my feelings. I apologize for being.
You sound like a guy named UFO Phil now, Robert.
Okay, let me read to you Aldrin's specific quote from this white paper, which is circulating inside NASA, and I have some news tonight from some other sources that NASA, in fact, Bill Gerstenmaier, who is on NASA TV right now, in a pre-recorded thing they've been running all day following the successful landing of Atlantis this morning, was actually revealing that this is going on officially in front of television cameras. They are now studying something that you and I have discussed on this show, George, called Direct,
right,
which is to basically take the existing shuttle elements, get rid of the orbiter, unfortunately, rearrange the tank and the boosters and place a new spacecraft on top and develop a heavy lift launch vehicle with the systems and the technology and expertise and the workforce that we already have in place without a gap, without a pause, so that we transition as fast as possible using the same technology into a heavy lift booster, which Griffin boasted that he already owned in the form of the 100-ton orbiter stack. So let me read you what Aldrin says on this. He says, a number of my former colleagues and other critics have expressed concerns about the plan, meaning the Obama plan. In particular, they expressed grave reservations about the gap, the end of the shuttle program, and the inability of the U.S. to provide human access to space, save for limited flight opportunities and capabilities with our Russian partners, pending the maturing of the commercial space transportation capabilities or other future systems to meet these needs. He then goes on to say, perhaps it is less widely known, well, it sure as heck is, that I, Aldrin, also share this concern and have long advocated a number of potential alternatives to address this issue. For the very near term, I have proposed extending or commercializing the space shuttle system, which would preserve the opportunity for reduced manifest, one or two flights per year, support of the International Space Station, while also preserving the capability to develop a shuttle-derived heavy-lift launch vehicle to meet our future space exploration needs and, as importantly, maintain the critical technical workforce. And that's
Here's the thing about that, okay?
Yep.
Okay, look, you know, the shuttle program came under criticism because they're spending $4 billion a year to launch typically four or five shuttles a year. So it was limited.
Excuse me.
Okay. Well, you've talked for a long time. Let me talk. Okay. So you can criticize that, and it's certainly worthy of criticism, but it's absurd to maintain a shuttle program and not fly the shuttle. And that just to keep people hired. The making a heavy lift vehicle out of the shuttle technology is certainly doable. As Gerstenmaier said, in fact, that idea has been around for ages. It was called Shuttle C in the early 1980s. You get rid of the orbiter, and you've got a heavy lift vehicle. The shuttle has the same takeoff thrust as a Saturn V. The problem is it's carrying a 100-ton orbiter to orbit, leaving only 20 tons left over for payload. It's like trying to haul cargo with a Winnebago. You can carry some cargo into the Winnebago, but you're better off getting rid of the mobile house and just having a flatbed there.
We agree, yes.
And if we want to build a heavy lift vehicle, you just get on with it.
Robert, we have to look at the practicality. Remember I said before, politics is 99% perception. Our problem is not technical. It's not really financial. It's all political.
Yeah,
we are lacking the political will to do the next big thing.
Well, wait, what's this we stuff?
We, the United States of America, in the form of official NASA-proposed policy by the current administration.
Well, no, the administration is refusing to do something sensible. They're willing to spend the money, but they're trying to guarantee that it is not spent effectively. To spend the same amount of money, $4 billion, $5 billion a year, needed to keep the shuttle program around while not launching any shuttles would be more than enough money to develop a heavy lift vehicle and, frankly, all the other hardware elements needed to get to Mars by the year 2020. All they have to do is say, our goal is to get to Mars by 2020. We've got $19 billion a year. How do we do it? And yes, then you can, if you want to keep the people employed that are currently working on the shuttle program, you say, look, guys, we're not hiring you, but we're giving you new jobs.
That's right.
This is your new job.
Switching you over.
This is what the direct proposal is. You take the same shuttle people who have worked with this technology, these systems, this engineering, and you have them reassemble that technology into a heavy lift vehicle minus the orbiter. So now you have 100 tons capability to lift into orbit, to assemble a Mars expedition, to go to the moon to practice, to go to Phobos, which we're going to get to, George, I hope.
Yes, we will.
And you can do all this within the current budget cap. You don't need unlimited money. And it's a pittance compared to, I'll remind everyone, $24 trillion we gave to the bankers, and bankers don't create one job.
But let me just say this: the direct proposal is fine. Okay, it's making a shuttle C. It's essentially the vehicle. If you read my book, The Case for Mars, I propose a launch vehicle which was called the Ares, which was this: make a heavy lift vehicle out of the shuttle components.
But that is different.
But excuse me. You're missing a key technical issue here. Okay. Making a heavy lift vehicle out of shuttle components is what we should do. Keeping the shuttle program as such around without launching shuttles and spending the money on that instead of making the shuttle into a heavy lift vehicle, those are two different things. And so what Buzz is saying is ridiculous.
No. He said, at the first part of the show, if you heard him, he said that ship has sailed, pun intended. He said with two missions left, maybe three, there's no point in extending the shuttle program.
Well, actually, I've heard Buzz give a talk which he said he wanted
tonight,
the shuttle program around
clearly,
to fly, excuse me, one shuttle a year for the next 5 years just to keep the shuttle program.
Yeah, no, that's what he did say. He wishes that's what would happen, but it's gone now.
Okay, window is closed. Now, you have 30,000-plus incredibly skilled workers. You have what we call institutional memory, which is the NASA workforce all the way from the probably Apollo, because the Mercury and Gemini guys are probably gone, but certainly from Apollo through to now. And that expertise and that memory cannot be lost, because if we scrap it, if we basically say the shuttle is it, we're going to go into R&D for 10 years, by the time we need to assemble whatever we've assembled in our research and development program into a space capability of human beings to other places.
You've lost the team.
You've lost everything. You've lost the team. You've lost the expertise. You've lost the memory. You know, so much of how engineering works, and you know this because you've been in industry, is not what's written down. It's what the guy down the line knows because he's been there for 10 years and he's seen all the stupid mistakes that you can make, and he knows how to save you from making them.
And this is an extremely destructive aspect of the Holdren plan.
Because it's deliberate.
Yeah.
Robert, I think you put your finger on the real problem here. Holdren's plan, it's not Obama's plan, it's Holdren, and he's listening to his science advisor. Holdren's plan, in essence, will not only kill NASA, it will ultimately wind up killing the United States of America, and that's why I'm determined to stop it, if I can.
I'm convinced it's a plan to force us to join with the Europeans and God knows who else to do a joint massive space effort.
Yeah, but we're doing that anyway.
But not really. I mean,
well,
this...
No, really, really, really. Who do you think built the Japanese modules? Who built the Canada arm? Who is providing our lift services from the former Soviet Union? We have had an international space program ever since the end of Apollo. That's not the problem. The problem is the United States has been leading that program, and it must continue to lead because there is no real leadership in those other countries.
They want a federation. It's going to be like Star Trek.
Well, there's George hit on an interesting idea here. In addition to being a Malthusian, Holdren is a member of a movement known as a Pugwash. And this was a pulling together of Anglo-American and Soviet elites with the idea that somehow they could join together and rule the world. And the Gore is also very much part of this. And now, when Gore became influential in NASA in the 1990s, running the space policy for the Clinton administration, what they started doing was transferring large amounts of American taxpayer dollars to the Russian elites under the guise of the space station program. And there's a very interesting book called Dragonfly, which discusses this. And it was written by a correspondent for Business Week. Talking about all these magnificent mansions going up around Baikonur, the Russian launch complex built with American taxpayer dollars, but we were creating an oligarchy in Russia and enriching it and an alliance with it. Now, it's interesting Holdren wants to make electric propulsion the basis for this futuristic Mars mission, and there's a lot of reasons why that's a wrong technical choice.
Electric propulsion? Stay with us, Robert. We're going to talk about that. We're going to get both your takes on whether we should go to Phobos, Mars's moon, one of them. We'll be back in a moment, and we'll take phone calls in the final hour of our space extravaganza. Very fast night. I'll be back. And welcome back. We're going to take your phone calls now with Robert Zubrin and Richard Hoagland. But first, Richard, I first want to get your take on Phobos and what we should do there.
Well, as you know, and this audience knows, we have discovered, and I don't know whether Robert's been following, but we have discovered that Phobos, the inner moon of Mars, discovered by Asa Paul back in 1877 at the U.S. Naval Observatory after he was photographing or looking for Martian satellites in August of 1877, we have now discovered that Phobos is an artificial object. And, Robert, don't faint. Just go look at the ESA photograph.
He already has.
Just go look at the ESA photograph.
All right.
And the ESA radar data, which has been published from the last several close encounters of the Mars Express orbiter with Phobos over the last several years. And at Enterprise, enterprisemission.com, we have a two-part paper called For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky, which is a title that I borrowed from my old friend Gene Roddenberry and Star Trek, because Phobos, unequivocally, when you get any mechanical engineer, any honest geologist, meaning someone who isn't, you know, getting their paycheck from NASA or the federal government, and any, you know, construction expert, they will look at these images and they will say to you and to me and to anybody, darn it, that's artificial. And the radar data is only the tip of the iceberg, because we've had sources out of Rome, out of the Marsis radar team, which is part of the Mars Express mission, that has, in fact, found the interior radar echoes from Phobos during these post-flybys, have been described variously as showing an internal firmament. And I actually had to go back to my original Latin and look that up. It means a foundation. It means support. It was the ancient idea. You know, we think of the term firmament as applied to the sky, as the expanse of stars and the night sky when you go outside and look up. Well, that idea of an expanse, a bowl, a constructed bowl, some kind of an artificial dome, came as the root of that word firmament in terms of what we see with our own eyes when we look up at the sky. So for this radar expert, who is one of the Mars's team, to have leaked that the interior of Phobos is like an internal firmament, meaning it is a constructed set of rooms and bulkheads and floors. And I know, Robert, this is probably striking you very strange, but we are expecting, as part of a political revelation this fall, during a major ESA meeting in Rome in September, prescinding to a final meeting in Moscow in November, where the Phobos results will be conveyed to the Russian Phobos Grunt team, which is organizing their next unmanned mission to Phobos in 2011, arriving in 2012, we expect that some of these data are actually going to be revealed as part of a slow revelation, a slow disclosure, that Mars is a lot more interesting than we have, any of us, except maybe a few of us here, have dared to dream up until now. And if you need to look at the substantiation of this, you go to Enterprise, you click on the two Phobos papers, you read them carefully. I have actually had go-betweens sending them to Buzz Aldrin. I don't know whether you get a chance to look at them yet. And in my 7 minutes with Buzz tonight, I didn't certainly have time to bring this up, but I would be very interested in his reaction, because if we can demonstrate, if the Europeans actually reveal that their data now is trending, that Phobos is not what we all thought it was going back decade after decade to the 1800s, then everything that Robert and Howard and Buzz and you, George, and I have discussed tonight becomes cast in a totally new light.
I want to get you back, Richard, for a much lengthier segment on this and your thoughts on this, because I got a million questions that we're not going to have time for tonight.
And
Robert, let's get your take on Phobos, and then we'll take calls.
Well, on Phobos, first of all, I guess Richard and I are going to have to agree to disagree. I don't think there's the remotest chance that Phobos is an artificial object.
Robert,
Richard, let me talk.
I have just sat on the table.
I let you talk without interruption. I would like to talk.
Robert.
Let me talk, Richard. Please let me talk. Thank you. Now, furthermore, however, many of these other people, like Buzz, talk about going to Phobos, not on the assumption that it's an artificial object, but that they believe that it might be a good base to explore Mars from. I also think this is false. Phobos is in equatorial orbit, which means the only place you can go to from Mars, from Phobos to Mars, is to the equator. And it's very difficult to get to from any point on Mars except the Martian equator. And frankly, if you want to go to Mars, you go to Mars. And the problem I have with this goal of Phobos is this, is that There's an infinite number of intermediate destinations that one can choose before you go to Mars. You say, well, before I go to Mars, I want to go to the moon. Before the Mars, I want to go to a near-Earth asteroid. Before Mars, I want to go to Phobos. Before I go to Mars, I want to go to Deimos. Before Mars, I want to go to the Lagrange point. And if you keep on adopting these alternative destinations, you never get to Mars. And so basically, we need to make a decision that our goal is Mars, and that's where we're going to go. You know, Phobos, someday people will go to Phobos as a side trip associated with going to Mars. But the idea that we should make Phobos a major destination, or we should try to build a base on Phobos or something, when the real discoveries are to be made on Mars. Mars, and furthermore, Mars is a planet that we can settle. It is a planet with a surface area equal to all the continents of the Earth put together that has on it all the resources needed to support life and therefore potentially human civilization. And for our generation, Mars is the new world. And, you know, it has the same relationship to our time as North America had to the Europeans in their age of exploration, and it's a far more important place to go than some little island in the middle of the Atlantic or in the Arctic somewhere that they could have gone to as well, and did, but it was a secondary aspect of the thing. Now, by the way, I just want to say the Mars Society is having an international convention to discuss all aspects of Mars exploration, and discussion of Phobos is certainly welcome in that. The convention is going to be August 5th through 8th at the Marriott Hotel in Dayton, Ohio. If people go to the Mars Society's website, which is marssociety.org, they can find out about the convention. It's going to be a terrific convention. It's going on 4 days. Former administrator Michael Griffin is going to be speaking there. Carolyn Porco, who's one of the lead scientists on the Cassini mission to Saturn, is going to be speaking there. I'll be speaking there. The convention's open to the public, and there's a registration fee, but anybody can come, and it's going to be spectacular. So it's the Marriott Hotel, Dayton, Ohio, August 5th through 8th.
Okay, and we're going to give Richard his rebuttal, then we'll take calls. Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, Robert, are you inviting me to present our Phobos data at your conference?
That's pretty
I'd have to think about that because I really think
why would
that,
you have to think? If you're
because
open,
the Phobos data that
why would hang on? Let me talk now. Thank
okay.
you. Why would you have to think an instant? You talk about freedom. You talk about the genesis of the United States. You talk about opening the system. Yet you are so closed that when I present you with an astonishing statement backed up by a paper that has been carefully researched, documented, written, and published, you claim it's impossible without even looking at the data. What kind of a scientist is that? And I'm now putting you on the spot. Absolutely. I'm asking you, will you invite me to present this data and a lot more that's going to come through the transom between now and August at your Mars conference this August?
Invite them, Robert. I mean, you got 90 people who gang up on the guy.
Well, I have to check it with the Mars Society
All
board.
Right, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. Richard, is that fair? Let him at least talk to the board about it.
That's okay.
He's not the board.
Now, let me raise a larger issue, which is if we're right, and the data says we're right, and data is supposed to be supreme in science, not theory, not prejudice, not preconceptions, but actual data, if the data is right, if Phobos, in fact, is the ancient remnant of an extraterrestrial civilization, then if we confirm that, either with robotic missions like the Phobos Grunt mission coming up in 2 years, or with an extension of Buzz Aldrin's idea, which is to send a human mission as soon as possible to Phobos, which is easier technologically in terms of celestial mechanics, in terms of fueling, in terms of the problems of entering atmospheres, et cetera, than any other place in the inner solar system, and bringing material home, artifacts, devices, potentially, you know, library books from whatever these guys left, everything that Robert and Buzz and Howard and you and I, George, have discussed tonight becomes totally academic. The American people, the world, will go crazy over funding any level of human space program that you and I and Robert and anybody else proposes, because that's been the holy grail. That's why, not so secretly, the American people have been funding NASA for all these years. They want to see if we're alone.
Now, are you saying that Phobos is artificial like an entire craft, or is it an asteroid that you believe they hollowed out?
Well, in honesty, we don't know. But it doesn't matter. If we find one artificial Quonset hut on Phobos, the game is over. We all win. The fact is the data indicates that Phobos is remarkable in terms of structure, in terms of geometry, in terms of potential engineering, in terms of potential science. I mean, Joseph Farrell and I are looking at this very seriously.
We'll do a show on this. I'll give you your due on Coast to Coast to present this, and then Robert can take this to his board and see what they want to do with this.
Well, it seems to me that if Robert wants what I want, which is to kickstart this administration and the you-know-what, to get us off our duffs to continue what was begun with Apollo 40 years ago, Robert should not be foreclosing anything that has the possibility of politically igniting the firestorm that will create the drive to inherit the solar system that Kraft Ericke and I discussed so many years ago.
He will bring in a crowd, Robert. That he will do.
Yeah. Well, I'd have to look into it. It's not the kind of thing we usually get into.
You mean data?
Phobos, we have photographs of Phobos. It looks like a near-Earth asteroid, that's frankly what it looks like. And I don't see any reason to believe it's anything but a near-Earth asteroid that was captured by Mars.
It's not about belief.
Well, we'll get your data, Richard. We'll do a show on the data, and then we'll see what Robert does with his board.
Well, Robert can go right now, click on Enterprise, download the paper.
He can't right now. I'm interviewing him.
I do many things on the computer while you're interviewing me.
Look, if you want me to tell people that you type with your toes, I will. Let's go to the phones here. We'll pick it up by going to Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut, on the wild card line. Go ahead, Bill.
Yes. Hi, Robert and Richard. Hi. I have two questions. I'll ask them together. Question number one, you mentioned Phobos. Another thing you should tell Robert to look at is, Richard, what you coined Data's head, or CP3O's head, the android-type head with a strange red stripe.
That was bizarre. I'll give him that.
Yes. It's a shorty crater of Apollo 17, and my point is, along with Robert, I'll get to question two in 1 second, along with Robert, show it that those photos to Buzz Aldrin or Edgar Mitchell or better, Gene Cernan or Jack Schmidt, who has been on the moon and know what the lighting on the moon looks like, and ask them, what is that? What is something that should have such a bright red stripe, redder than the orange soil that Gene Cernan and Jack Schmidt brought back to Earth from a few yards away, and much more redder than Gene Cernan's spacesuit or space helmet is with a red stripe. Now, question number two is, where would we be, NASA be today, if Nixon had not canceled Apollos 18, 19, and 20, but instead had continued the production lines of the Saturn V rocket and everything, the command module, lunar rover, and add-on?
Let me answer the second
Robert,
question.
You take the second, Richard gets the first.
The second, Richard answers the first. How's that? That's
deal.
Fair deal?
Deal.
Okay, with respect to the second, if Nixon had not aborted the program, we would have had a lunar base by the late 1970s. We would have had our first human mission to Mars by 1981. We would have had a permanent Mars base by 1988. And the first children born on Mars, would probably be graduating high school on Mars right about now.
All right. Richard, let's give you your take on Bill's first question.
Well, the 800-pound gorilla in the room, or the invisible pink elephant that no one wants to talk about, is the fact that NASA has found the remains of an ancient civilization all over the solar system, and they've sat on it. You know, I wrote with Mike Barra, a New York Times bestseller, putting this evidence forward, and the numbers of people buying that book, politically voting with their dollars for what they really want NASA to fess up to, is obvious of the constituency that's out there that can be harnessed in pursuit of what's really in the solar system if we're really serious about wanting to open up the Earth from being a closed Malthusian down to the primeval sea into an open system with an unlimited future for every one of the 6 billion plus human beings who are living on this planet tonight. It is no less stark than that. And I would like an opportunity in a decent forum with a fair audience and a fair review to present the data which supports this position that I've been working on for the last something like 30 years.
Next up, we go to Corey in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Corey, go ahead.
Hey, gentlemen. How are you doing?
All is well. Thank you. I say that a lot, don't I?
I was going to ask about the X-33 program and the Venture Star program that was canceled by George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I don't understand why we can't have a viable system with what we have right now, being our space shuttle, just upgrading it.
Well,
why in the world could we not do that?
That's a good question. Robert, first of all, I think these shuttles really do have a finite life to them, don't they?
Sure. The shuttles, I mean, yeah,
the shuttle
is like 30 years old.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't want to get on a 30-year-old plane whenever I fly from St. Louis to D.C. or L.A. I prefer a newer one if I had a choice.
But you probably have.
But I probably have.
Well, now, wait a minute, guys. The B-52, which has been the backbone of the Strategic Air Command from its inception in the 1950s, in the B-52G or H, I forget what model series, is still flying and is still the backbone of our deterrent in terms of winged aircraft.
Well, but very few of them are the original B-52s.
But they've been modified.
Okay, the real point, though, is the B-52 is a well-designed bomber. Shuttle is not a well-designed booster.
May I finish? We're not talking about the shuttle as a booster. We're talking about the shuttle as an orbiter. I have watched Jim Shannon. I've watched all these shuttle missions. I watched the NASA press conference this afternoon. Atlantis, which just returned this morning, had the cleanest flight on record. Those shuttles were built for 100 flights. Atlantis has only flown 32. That means its design life is not over if you can solve the stupid problem of the foam falling off the tank and killing the orbiter, which under a great deal of effort, NASA finally got around to doing it the way they should have done it in the beginning.
Yeah, but the problem with the shuttle is it's a bad vehicle. You're trying to haul freight with a Winnebago.
But
why the shuttle program is
so unobvious. He's right, Richard.
Robert, do you understand the concept, the best is the enemy of the good?
Hold on, guys. We're coming right back on Coast to Coast AM. Boy, they started off docile, and now they're just punching each other. We'll be back. This has been just a rocket ship night, very fast. We've got Bob Zubrin with us, Richard C. Hoagland as well. And right at the end of this program, we'll give you an opportunity to find out exactly where each person will be with their respective work and what they do. And let's go to final callers now. We have you, Joe in Rochester, New York, east of the Rockies. Welcome to the program. Hi, Joe. Go ahead.
How you doing?
Okay.
I hope you give me about 10 minutes because I got an argument for about 20 things.
I can't give you 10 because I'll be off the air.
That.
But go ahead. Do the best you can.
Yes, I will. I'm more interested in low Earth orbit and geosynchronous orbit and space solar power satellites. If we can build these things about the size of half a tractor trailer load and launch them, in Japan they're being designed to provide energy for 500,000 households. And what that means, you can have an energy beam that boils water at coal-fired fossil fuel boilers or atomic energy boilers, eliminate pollution, and reduce the price of electricity to perhaps $20 a household for a 10-year period.
All right, well, let's find out from you, Robert. What do you think of that? And also, you were talking about electrical propulsion, which, of course, we both agree is not a good idea. Go ahead.
Well, beaming solar energy down from space, I don't think it's going to be practical for a very long time. Solar energy on the surface of the Earth is not yet competitive with more commercial ways of making power like nuclear power or even fossil power. So I think what we need to do is set our goal. In other words, our goal of going into space, it should be to establish humanity on new worlds. And for a while, it may cost money to do that. You can't base that on the assumption that it's going to be profitable by being able to beam power back from space. And certainly in terms of dealing with our energy problem here of breaking free from the OPEC oil cartel, we can't depend on such solutions. This is an extreme emergency. We have to – Congress has – I have a book called Energy Victory that discusses this problem. Congress could break OPEC with a stroke of a pen just by passing a law requiring that all new cars sold in the U.S. be flex-fueled, that is able to run equally well on gasoline, ethanol, or methanol. And methanol we can make from any kind of biomass, from natural gas, from coal, from recycled trash. It's selling right now for 90 cents a gallon. If our cars were able to run on it, OPEC wouldn't stand a chance. That's what we need to do about that. Certainly we should explore the potential of solar energy in space. But I don't at this point business plan doesn't close. And this thing about electric propulsion, this is an idea electric propulsion, or sometimes called ion drives or plasma drives, they have a much higher exhaust velocity than chemical rockets. So in principle, they could get you to go a lot faster. The problem is they need a lot of electricity. And you have the Obama people saying, oh, we're going to develop this new electric propulsion system that will allow us to get to Mars in a month and a half instead of 6 months, but it requires a 200,000 kilowatt space electric power supply, a space nuclear power supply, and they have no intention of developing any space nuclear power supply. So they're developing an electric rocket without a socket for it to plug into. And that is an example of how making your program technology-driven as opposed to destination-driven, you end up developing random parts of things instead of coherent systems that can actually do something.
All right, Richard, do you want to take this too?
Yeah, because, again, Robert and I are in 100% agreement.
You both have been most of the night.
I have loved Robert's suggestion for flex fuels. I think it is the way to break the oil monopoly, and it's a transition technology, but it would empower a lot of people, and that's, of course, why I'm against space solar power. Look, I was part of a study team with Glazer and Phil Chapman and others back in the 70s when space solar power was all brand new and sexy and cool, and, you know, we looked at it, and the showstopper that I see, in fact, I see two, one is environmental. Environmentalists are never going to let you beam megawatts of electricity down from orbit from 22,300 miles out to rectennas covering a lot of Arizona or whatever. They just won't. And politically, they will stop you dead in the water. I mean, look at how we can't even seem to break the back of the banks who are stealing us blind, or the oil companies who are, polluting the planet to the point where the entire Gulf Coast is going to be uninhabitable and nothing is being done because of the power of oil lobbies. Well, the environmental lobby is very strong, and they will never let you put a solar power plant in orbit, and it's also a dumb idea. I know there are certain guests on Coast that come up with this from time to time. Charles Schulz is really, big on this.
Mm-hmm.
The primary reason I'm against it, because I think the environmental stuff by the numbers could be finessed, but I don't want more big centralized power. The name of the game is freedom. Robert and I agree on that. And the name of the game in terms of energy is diversified power. Thin film solar technology now is so close to breaking the back of the fossil fuel monopoly that it will, within, I'd say, the next 5 years, with even a modicum of enhancement, which the Obama administration has quietly done, it will take the field, and you will put solar panels on your home. You will get off the grid. It will be reasonable and cheap to do so. And no one can ever cut your power off because there's nobody at the other end that you have to pay a bill to once you've paid for the technology. Now, in terms of electric transportation to Mars, I also agree here that unless there is some unseen technology waiting in the wings, the idea of Vastomir or other electric thrusters, Hall thrusters, whatever, is a very nice idea with no place to plug it into, because you can't build enough solar cells light enough. It's basically a mass problem. You can't build enough solar cells to collect enough electricity that will create a spacecraft that you can actually move to Mars in any reasonable time frame, because the solar cells themselves will weigh so much that it basically cuts your advantages to almost zero. So we really need to rethink this idea of electrical, you know, drives in space is the answer to everything, because without a power supply, as Robert said, it ain't.
Let's go to Santa Barbara, California, west of the Rockies. We've got Nancy there. Nancy, take it away.
Hi, gentlemen. How are you tonight, this morning?
We're having a good time. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, I'm wondering if you are familiar with Andrew Basiago's claim that he teleported to Mars.
Yeah, don't get me started on him, please.
Oh, I want to know.
Why, Richard? Tell us.
Because he's a nut. He's an absolute 100% nut. And he is being paid by the intelligence agencies to spread disinformation far and wide. And I will take an entire program and prove that. But you raised the question. You wanted an honest answer. And that's my answer.
All right. There you go. Richard C. Hoagland calling someone a nut. Let's go to San Diego, California. John, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Great, George. I was wondering, what do you gentlemen know about the Kistler syndrome and space debris? And I've been talking to Marshall H. Kaplan, and he says that...
what syndrome?
Kistler syndrome.
Kistler syndrome. Okay.
Kistler, the idea that space debris will wipe out everything that we have up there, and there won't be any broadband, there won't be any transportation, period. And we're designing something that's two-stage orbit, but that'll be the new shuttle program with space launch, but, you know, with a black hole engine that Marshall knows. Do you know Marshall H. Kaplan?
I've heard the name, and I'm very, very skeptical.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, so why would you be skeptical? He's worked with Kistler, he's worked with Beale. He's worked with Dave Thompson with Orbital Sciences.
Yeah, the problem is, how do you create a black hole?
Well, he says his buddy has created an engine, but that's not the issue. The issue is, how are we going to take care of the space debris?
Robert, you want to take this one on space debris?
Well, you know, there's some space debris in Earth orbit, but we've been able to operate there, and to my knowledge, it's never caused a serious accident with a manned spacecraft. I think that there was a satellite that was severely damaged by space debris, but it's a hazard, but compared to all the other risks there are in space travel, it's one of the more minor ones.
And it can be handled.
Yeah.
There are now plans for literally mopping up. For instance, you can use lasers to deorbit the biggest pieces, and the small pieces take care of themselves, because even at 200 miles, there is air, and there is friction, and this little tiny stuff comes down. So it's clearing the big pieces, but you have to have, again, the political will. And if you're going to set up an infrastructure in near-Earth orbit, an industrial infrastructure, that will be part of the planning, because you can't just let space debris, you know, promulgate endlessly without taking care of it.
Richard, tell us about the conference you've got coming up with Stephen Greer, and then we'll get Robert to mention his event, and we'll wrap up with final calls.
Well, in October, I have been invited to speak at Stephen Greer's Disclosure Conference. As you know, we don't do UFOs at Enterprise, but I've chosen to accept his invitation this year because there are such rapid developments on the space front, including insights and data on the secret space program, which, of course, we have not had time to discuss tonight, that I'm going to be revealing some very important data at his conference. I think it's the first weekend in October in Arizona, near Tucson, and we are going to obviously hit this several times before we get to October.
All right. Robert Zubrin, your Mars Society event?
The Mars Society conference will be at the Marriott Hotel in Dayton, Ohio, August 5th through 8th. And so that's 4 days, and people can find out more about the conference at marssociety.org, and there's discount rates available at the hotel for all conference attendees, and there's information about that at the website. We're going to have Mike Griffin's going to be speaking there. I'm going to be speaking there, Carolyn Porco, many other speakers, and discussing all aspects of Mars exploration and settlement.
And maybe a surprise guest.
And maybe a surprise guest could happen.
Oh, really? Oh, it could be Richard, I guess. Let's go to Goldberg, North Carolina. Jeff, thank you for holding. Jeff, go ahead.
Hello, guys. Enjoyed your show. One comment and then one question for Robert Zubrin. Comment is we've already had a six-year gap in human spaceflight, at least American human spaceflight, between 1975 at the end of the Apollo-Soyuz test program and the launch of the space shuttle to 1981. So having a gap in a human space program is not that big a deal, in my opinion. And we're still going to be launching astronauts. We're just going to be launching them on the Soyuz. My question for Robert Zubrin, Donald Rapp has written a book called Human Missions to Mars, where he criticizes a lot of the conclusions you've reached, Robert, you and the NASA folks, about our technology readiness. He says we're not ready in cryogenic storage or in artificial gravity as far as rotating spacecraft, entry, descent, and landing for heavy vehicles, and nuclear power reactors in space. And I'm wondering if you've read his book and his criticism and what you think are the biggest technology development need is for a human mission to Mars.
Okay, well, I've read his book, and I know Don Rapp. He lists a bunch of problems, and he just basically paints them as inseparable when they're not. We do know how to store cryogenic propellants in space for a finite amount of time, and we only need to store cryogens on the way to Mars for 6 months. We know how to do that. We know how to build a space nuclear power reactor. In the Mars Direct Plan, we don't need to build a 200,000-kilowatt space nuclear reactor. We need a 100-kilowatt, not 100,000, 100-kilowatt. Okay, these are all doable things. Yeah, we don't have a heavy lift booster, but we know how to build one. We built one and flew one in the 1960s. I mean, someone could have written a book like this at the beginning of Apollo, with much more justice, by the way, talking about all the different problems and making it seem impossible, but we solved them all. And, the degree of technological problems that we have to solve to go to Mars from what we know now is much smaller than what we had to solve to go to the moon starting from where we were in 1961. And to say that we can't solve these problems is really saying we've become much less than the people we used to be, and I don't think we can afford that.
Okay.
Yeah, if I can jump in here.
Yeah, please,
George.
Rich, a couple minutes ago. Go ahead.
Yeah, George, I, again, find myself agreeing with Robert almost 100%. What we lack is not capability, knowledge base, industry, technology. We lack the political will, which brings us to this audience. Guys and gals, everyone listening to us tonight, if you give a damn about the future of the United States of America and the future of NASA as a catalyst to the kind of future that Robert and I think we all deserve, then you need to express your opinions to this Congress, to this House, to this Senate, to the space committees. Google them. You can find them easily. Send them your reactions. Send them your thoughts. Send them your intentions. They're in a mode of listening because there is bipartisan support for Robert and Buzz and my position and George's and Howard's, and not for the Obama position. And we need to take that and leverage it into a program we all can be proud of and we all can ride to the 21st century that we deserve.
All right, very good. One more call. That'll be it. San Bernardino, first-time caller. It's you, Brian. Go ahead.
Hello. Hi, George.
Hi, Brian.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you guys have heard anything about, I guess, these extraterrestrial beings telling NASA, like, not to return to the moon. And then I got a quick comment. I just want to say that the only way to heaven is through Jesus Christ.
Well, I wouldn't argue with that. But we've heard rumors since the space program that we were told, don't go back to the moon. But every astronaut I have asked has said, no, that's never happened. That's never come up. It's never been the case. And so be it. So, Richard, let's let you do a quick 30-second wrap-up, and then you, Robert, 30 seconds. I'll interrupt right after that.
Well, the name of the game to me is the future. The current Obama plan, which is really John Holdren's plan, who is the president's science advisor, you know, neophyte of Paul Ehrlich, the guy who thought we were all going to die of too many people decades ago, Aldrin's plan is not a program. It is a program for the demise of the United States as a free people. We need a NASA that will carry the banner to Mars and beyond with the technology we have in hand. We don't need to develop anything more. We just need the political will to apply it. And that's why your expression of your interest in the Senate and House is critical.
Oh, okay. Robert, 10 seconds.
Yeah. Well, yeah, look, if we're going to have a NASA, we need to go somewhere. The place to go is Mars. And if you have a plan, it means you really intend to do it. It means we make the goal Mars in our time, not Mars in the 23rd century. And this is what we need. You know, it's ironic. Obama ran on a program of hope.
And
the Aldrin program is designed to kill hope.
Thank you, Robert. Thank you, Richard. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Ladasur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.